Iran's president arrives in China for a three-day visit aimed at strengthening economic cooperation between the two countries. Russia rejects as unfounded allegations that it's plotting to destabilize Moldova. Also coming up, at least the three people are killed and five others injured after a gunman opened fire on a university campus in the U.S. state of Michigan. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi is in China for a state visit aimed at building up bilateral ties. Raisi was welcomed by the Chinese Minister of Culture and Tourism upon arrival at Beijing International Airport. The Iranian president will be receiving an official welcome by his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping in a few hours. Iran and China are set to sign 20 cooperation documents during the visit. Before his departure, Raisi said that Tehran and Beijing share the same stance when it comes to countering unilateralism.
Both Iran and China are opposed to unilateralism and support political independence around the world. This shared stance has brought the two countries close enough that they can have good political and economic cooperation at regional and international levels.
Raisi said he would focus on the implementation of the 25-year strategic cooperation agreement signed with China 2 years ago. He said Tehran and Beijing already enjoy close relations, but there's still much room for expanding cooperation in different sectors, including trade and economy. The president said Iran's accession to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization has paved the way for closer ties with Beijing. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed in depth the significance of the Iranian president's visit to China.
But I'd like to welcome my guest to this news review. Out of Tehran, Fuad Izzadi, academic and political analyst, and out of Kitchener, Ontario, Robert Fatina, author and journalist. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start this off in Tehran with Mr. Izzadi. Your perspective on the significance of this trip at this time?
You know, we are moving towards a multipolar world. China, it seems, is going to be one of the poles in the New World Order. Iran has the potential to be a pole in the New World Order. And the cooperation of these countries, countries that are resisting U.S. Hegemony, is quite important. It's beneficial for both sides. Iran is obviously under heavy sanctions from the United States, so having a close economic linkage with China is going to be good for Iran. And China is heavily dependent on energy resources of the Persian Gulf. And Iran is the only country that its foreign policy is not dictated from Washington. Other countries in this part of the world are heavily influenced by the United States. That's something that Chinese leaders understand. And so it's beneficial for them to make sure that they have good relations with Iran. It's a win-win situation, and I think in the next 3 days we will see the benefits of this cooperation presented to the public and to the international observers.
Well, Robert Fatina, your take, it almost appears as if the United States is forcing more and more alliances because of the unilateral policies that it has, the sanctions, and all-out pressure on so many countries. Your assessment of the United States' moves that perhaps actually encourages and, and forces many of these type alliances.
Yes, certainly. Things like the sanctions against Iran, the aggressive rhetoric against China, have the opposite effect of what the United States wants them to have. When the United States sanctioned Iran, it hoped that the Iranian government would come back to the bargaining table. That didn't happen. Instead, Iran went elsewhere, in this case to China, to establish alliances. They'll be military, they'll be economical. They will be things that will benefit the people of Iran, which is what the Iranian government should do. So the U.S. is, in wanting to ostracize different countries, it's causing them to join together into alliances, which will help them become more powerful, will become more of a check to the United States, which is a very good thing, because the United States for so many decades has just operated around the world in a very destructive and very negative manner. It's estimated to have killed at least 20 million people since the end of World War II. And Iran and China, with their growing alliances, can act as a check to that, because the U.S. may be a little less willing to engage in some military misadventures anywhere in the world, knowing that it will be opposed to by this powerful new union. So the United States government, as usual, is not doing anything that benefits its own people or the people of the world. In fact, it acts to their detriment on a regular basis.
Okay, and on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me here on this news review of what is the academic and political analyst out of Tehran, Robert Fantina, author and journalist out of Ontario.
Moving on, a week after a powerful earthquake struck Syria and Turkey, the two countries are still overwhelmed by grief. But it is punctuated by rare moments of joy as rescuers pull out people alive from the rubble of collapsed buildings. In one of the latest such moments, a 10-year-old girl was rescued in Turkey's Kahramanmaraş province. There were similar heartwarming scenes in Hatay and Adıyaman provinces. Hopes, however, of finding many more survivors are quickly fading in cold temperatures. Such expectations are even lower across the border in war-torn Syria, which lacks the rescue and relief equipments. In the city of Aleppo, the UN aid chief said the rescue phase was coming to a close. The focus is now switching to shelter, food, and schooling. The death toll from the 7.8 magnitude quake last Monday and the massive tremor just hours later now stands at above 37,000. Nearly 32,000 of the fatalities are confirmed in Turkey alone. Our Istanbul correspondent Rashan Saglam says there could be more people alive under the rubble, despite the hope for finding them are fading away 7 days after the catastrophe.
Actually, miracles are still happening, especially in the city of Adıyaman or the province of Adıyaman. A man and his son were rescued after 177 hours. A four-year-old boy was rescued after 178 hours. Also after 177 hours, a young man, 35 years old, in Adıyaman was rescued. And in Antakya, a woman was rescued after 177 hours. So miracles are still happening. And the Turkish rescue teams are still continuing to search for people alive under the debris. They still have hope, especially with this weather. It is easier with the cold weather for people to stay alive more under the debris. Usually it is 7 days after an earthquake happens, but in hotter areas or hotter weathers. Now, due to the cold weather and sometimes due to the snow and rain, people under the debris in a way or another are finding it easier to stay alive. And some of them said that they were drinking from the water coming inside to them under the debris from the snow that was falling. So this is a miracle coming from God.
Meanwhile, the UN chief says Syria has agreed to open two more border crossings to allow in aid into militant-held areas affected by last week's devastating earthquake. Antonio Guterres says the open crossings will allow more and faster aid delivery from Turkey into northwestern Syria. Previously, the Bab al-Hawa crossing was the only conduit for the delivery of humanitarian aid into the region. Syria is concerned that the border crossings are used to supply Western arms to terrorists. On Monday, the UN Security Council held a closed-door meeting on the humanitarian situation in Syria following the quake. This is what the Syrian ambassador to the United Nations had to say to the reporters following the meeting.
During today's meeting, I convey to the Council that the Syrian government has repeatedly expressed its commitment to deliver humanitarian aid to Syrians, whatever they are on the Syrian soil. And I also affirmed that Northwest Syria is an integral part of Syrian lands, and that our people there are part of the Syrian people. And Syria will not accept that they be divided based on lines drawn by terrorist armed groups. Based on that, Syria supports the entry of humanitarian aid into the region through all possible cross points, whatever from inside Syria or across the border, for the period of 3 months.
Earlier, the UN also warned that terrorists in control of northern Syria are hampering the delivery of aid by Damascus. More than 4 million people live in militant-controlled areas of northwestern Syria. Palestinian resistance factions have held a conference in the besieged Gaza Strip to drum up support for Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank amid the increasing Israeli aggression and the use of lethal force against Palestinians. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon has more from Gaza.
Hundreds of people attended a national conference in Gaza, which was organized by Palestinian resistance factions. The event aims to bolster the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank. In recent weeks, extremist Israeli settlers and political figures backed by regime forces have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Israeli forces have also killed and injured dozens of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of 2023. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said the resistance in Gaza is ready to support the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank.
We will not leave the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank alone, and we will back them with all the necessary means. The occupying regime will not be able to divide the Palestinian resistance arenas. Last night, we witnessed unity in Gaza, Nablus, and Al-Quds.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces more than 55 years ago, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom.
Actually, Al-Quds is not just a word. It's something apart from our heart. So this conference asking and telling the world that this Israeli action against Al-Quds and West Bank must be stopped.
Palestinian resistance factions have expressed their unwavering support for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. They also vowed to use all forms of resistance to liberate Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank.
We believe that the Israeli government, under the leading of Netanyahu and Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, going to raising up the aggressive against our people in West Bank, in Jerusalem, in Gaza also, maybe in other outside countries also. So we are going to resent the occupation by all kind of resistance.
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank while turning a blind eye to violations committed by the Israeli regime against them for decades. Palestinians say that they will continue their struggle against the Israeli regime until the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Russia has dismissed an allegation by Moldova that Moscow is plotting to destabilize the country. Russia's foreign ministry has censured the claims as completely unfounded. The ministry is blaming Ukraine for stirring tensions between Russia and Moldova. It has said Kiev is trying to draw Moldova into a tough confrontation with Russia. This comes after Moldovan President Maia Sandu accused Moscow of planning to use foreign saboteurs to bring down the country's leadership. She said Moscow seeks to prevent her country from joining the European Union and use it in the war in Ukraine. Elsewhere, at least three people are confirmed dead in yet another incident of gun violence in the United States. Five others have been hospitalized after the shooting at Michigan State University. Some of them are in life-threatening condition. The incident saw a gunman open fire at several sites inside the campus. He later shot himself dead. The university attack came nearly 14 months after a teenager killed four people at a high school in Oxford, Michigan. The U.S. has seen a surge in gun violence over the past years. Such incidents have killed 25 people since the beginning of the year. And that brings an end to International Bulletin for this hour.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, you heard that 10 days after Imam Khomeini is going to Kuwait from Iraq and then leaving Kuwait immediately for France, his wife and family made preparations to join him in Paris. Before going to Paris, they held the martyrdom anniversary of the Imam's elder son, Haj Aqa Mustafa, and 4 days later left for Paris. Stay tuned for the rest of the story.
Mm-hmm.
The arrival of Imam Khomeini's wife, Lady Khadija Saqafi, in Paris was amazing and interesting to those who met her, as she was acquainted with French language. Haj Ahmad and some of the friends had come to the airport to welcome her. There was a student among them by the name of Nasreen Hakami, who was studying postgraduate in sociology. When the car carrying Miss Saqafi entered the streets of Paris, she started reading the signs. Some of her co-travelers were surprised, and Miss Hakami asked her if she knew French. The imam's wife answered that she had learned it before high school and continued, ironically, "Yet you shouldn't expect me to help you with your lessons." In those days, many religious families were opposed to women's education outside homes. The polite and solemn behavior of Ms. Saqafi attracted the neighbors and people in Neuf-le-Château village in the outskirts of Paris. She used to stand up for guests and foresee them up the exit door. When the visitors saw her respectful, sincere, and plain conduct, they would be astonished and ask if she was the wife of the man who had staged a revolution in the world. Lady Khadija Saqafi, besides warm welcome and hospitality towards guests, used to answer their questions quiet, calmly, and patiently. This would make people interested in her, and they would become curious to know more about Imam Khomeini and his movement. One of the women who had met Imam Khomeini's wife describes her as follows. She looked very stylish in the chocolate coat and skirt, which was set with her cream shirt. She had a flowery chador on her shoulders with a headscarf which was fit with her coat and shirt. She was sitting on the ground, and we asked her to sit on the chair. She said, "It would be very bad if you sit on the ground while I'm sitting on the chair." At last, our insistence made her to sit on the chair, but the shame on her face showed her humbleness and plainness very well. Some of the visitors would ask political questions from the imam's wife. This would make it a little difficult, as she had to answer the questions on the one hand, while avoiding answers which would cause the despotic regime in Iran to misuse the answers. Thus, she would answer some of the questions subtly and smartly. Sometimes she would say with a smile, "I am a political scholar's wife and not he himself." Some of the questions were about possible differences in her life with the imam. She would answer like this: "Both the imam and I reach an agreement in many differences, as we recognize differences of opinion, and very rarely do we dispute." Once she was asked if she was worried as her security was threatened. She answered, "Firstly, security is related with feeling. A part of it is real, while another part is the feeling that cowardly people would feel even if with 100 guards. Thank God the imam is so brave that there is no fear in our house in the light of his bravery. Moreover, naturally, I am not a coward." Imam Khomeini's wife enjoyed lofty characteristics like her husband, and she didn't have any personal grudge against the Shah and his family. Thus, when the Shah was escaping from the country, she was impressed. Late Ms. Marzieh Hadidchi Dabbagh, who was in Paris in the last months of the imam's stay, narrated an interesting account on this. "The day when the Shah went, the sounds of people's joy and the slogans of 'Death to the Shah' were heard. The people in Neuf-le-Château, too, were happy. But when I said good night to the lady, Miss Safi, she was calm and quiet. And the next morning when she got up, there was no sign of joy in her face. I told her something to make her laugh. I said, lady, I congratulate you as the Shah has gone. She said, we should congratulate you as you have been tortured in the prisons of Savak. But I wish this did not happen. I wish he had listened to the Imam's words in 1962 and had come to the nation so that he would not lose his popular support while going under the yoke of superpowers. I do not express happiness for the evil fate of anyone. I wish he had not become a Shah in the beginning and would not hear the chants of death to Shah these days. When I think of what a hard night he and his wife Farah are going to pass, I don't know what to say. I hope they will not commit any evil deed from now on so that their load of sins becomes heavier.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. 2022 was the deadliest year for Palestinians on the West Bank. Since the United Nations started keeping records in 2005, 146 Palestinians were killed in the West Bank last year. But already this year, the Zionist entity seems to be on its way to breaking that record. We're only halfway through the second month of 2023, and already Israel has killed around 50 Palestinians in the West Bank. Israel has also regularly bombed Gaza, and now with a right-wing cabinet in place, the situation is only expected to get worse. Israel's far-right cabinet has approved the legislation of 9 settler outposts in the occupied West Bank. All settlements are illegal, according to international law, but who pays attention to international law in this occupied land? Well, I'd like to start this spotlight off, and I'd like to welcome my guests to the program.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I appreciate both of you being with me here on the Spotlight, starting it off in Gaza City. And Mr. Mohammed Abu Saada, why do you think we're seeing an exacerbation in the violence committed by Israeli forces against the Palestinians now.
Many thanks for having me in your program.
Thank you for coming.
Israel has been occupying Palestinian land for over half a century now. It's been 55 years of the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory, West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. And according to the Israeli human rights group, B'Tselem, which is an Israeli human rights group, has classified Israel as an apartheid and occupation regime, which is systematically killing the Palestinians. As you just mentioned, around 50 Palestinians have been killed, killed by Israel since the beginning of this year, 2023. Over the year 2022, more than 230 Palestinians were killed by Israel in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. And let me also add that since the beginning of this year, Israel has demolished 34 homes or housing units that belong to the Palestinians, justifying that the Palestinians have no permit for those buildings. Israel has systematically gone after the Palestinians in a way that has been described by many UN experts as a collective punishment against more than 5 million people who live in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. And unfortunately, Israel has so far succeeded from any international sanctions or any international punishments for its violation of international law and its violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which very much describe all of Israeli activities in the Palestinian territories as illegal and must stop immediately.
Okay, let me get our other guests in. And Feras, good to see you. How much of what we're seeing has to do with the right-wing Israeli government in place at this time, and how much does it have to do simply with the occupied entity that it is?
Yes, you know, it's everybody knows that Israel is an illegitimate regime from its foundation. It's a colonial project. It was, you know, installed and planted in West Asia that they call Middle East to, you know, have a base to support the colonial powers such as the British, the French, and the Americans. And this Israeli regime right now really represents, you know, the peak of how criminal and how colonial of an entity this is. We can see that they have no mercy towards the Palestinians, no respect for international law. They feel like there's no accountability in any way because there's truly, there is no accountability. The United Nations is a tool now being used, you know, to support certain agendas and to help the some criminal regimes to get away with their crimes. There's no punishment. How many times has the Israeli regime breached international law? How many times have they violated the human rights and killed innocent people, such as Shireen Abu Akleh not too long ago, an iconic, well-known journalist? You know, she was shot bluntly. She had an American citizen as well, and they didn't do nothing about it. They haven't, you know, there's no investigation. There's no, you know, real punishment against the Israeli regime. So the Israeli regime really feels they have a green light to commit any crime without any type of accountability. Mm-hmm. And this is the problem that we're having, is the United Nations that people trust and feel like this is a system that's supposed to support the world peace and hold people, you know, accountable for committing crimes. So the criminals are actually supported by the United Nations. And the Israeli regime today with Netanyahu and all these right-wing extremist radicals really shows what this system has become and what the system's roots were.
Okay.
I mean, this is truly a criminal state from the beginning and to the end.
All right, turning back to Gaza. Muhammad, with the approval of more illegal occupation on the West Bank, do you think that we will see more aggressive measures taken by Palestinians as a reaction?
Well, that is definitely a very good question. Let me say that Israeli settlement in the Palestinian territories or Israeli illegal settlement in the Palestinian territories has not started as a response to Palestinian attacks or a response to Palestinian resistance to the Israeli occupation. Israel is just trying to in a way trying to legitimize its illegal activities in the Palestinian territories by describing these activities as in retaliation for Palestinian attacks against Israelis. Since 1967, Israel has planted more than 800,000 Israeli Jewish settlers in the West Bank and the city of Al-Quds. Just yesterday, the Israeli right-wing government has decided to legalize 9 illegal outposts which has been implanted by extremist Israeli settlers on the hills of the West Bank. And let me say that this Israeli latest decision to legalize this illegal outpost is a slap on the face for the American administration, which has been trying lately by sending many of its top diplomats to the region to try to convince the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his government to stop Israeli settlement expansion in the Palestinian territories.
Well, let me just jump in here, Mohammed. Let me just jump in here with what you said. So you really feel that the United States want the Israelis to stop expanding the settlements?
Well, that is a very critical question, to be honest with you. But let me say that on the record, the U.S. administration during the Obama administration did not veto a UN Security Council resolution in December 2016 in the last days of the Obama administration. And that administration did not veto that decision, which in a way described Israeli settlement activity in the Palestinian territories as illegal and must be stopped. Now, the current U.S. administration has been repeatedly saying that it's with the two-state solution. It's with the integrity of the Palestinian territory where the Palestinians can have their own state on the West Bank and East Jerusalem. But unfortunately, the U.S. has failed miserably to stop Israel, or has failed to stop this Israeli settlement activity.
Okay.
We haven't seen any sanctions by U.S., or we haven't seen any measures by the U.S. to stop Israeli settlement activity in the Palestinian territories. But if you allow me just to go back to the question, We do expect that we will be seeing more and more Palestinian retaliation against Israeli activities, because the Palestinians feel that they are left on their own, that the international community is not holding Israel responsible, mm-hmm. the Arab region is not punishing Israel, and the Palestinians feel that they have to take matters under their own hand by defending themselves against the Israeli apartheid and occupation regime.
All right. Well, Faraz, your take on that. Do you think, as our previous guest just talked about, during the Obama presidency, because they did not veto a certain situation in the UN, that the United States actually wants Israel to stop expanding their settlement activities? How, your assessment of that, if Washington really wanted it to do it, do you think that it could make Israel do what it wants?
Yes, we it's very clear that if the U.S. wanted to really punish or stop the Israelis from doing some major crimes, they could. And they have the power to do that, because they have veto in the United Nations and so on. And they have other measures that they can take. But the U.S. is playing games, as usual. You know, sometimes they might veto a certain thing, make it look like they care about Palestinian human rights, because they're ashamed at certain times in front of the world. So they want to make it look like they have some type of respect for human rights and humanity, because they're sometimes under fire and being questioned and things like that. So they kind of want to have something manipulated to be able to present that we did support the Palestinians, we did send some pocket change to the Palestinians to support them, and so on. But this is all a game. They do not care about the human rights in Palestine. They have always supported the Israeli regime, and they're always protecting the Israeli regime, and they're always making sure that the Israeli regime is progressing and growing with all their crimes. And this is very clear in the Zionist lobbies in the U.S., the Zionist lobbies in the West in general, in Canada, and so on. They all work together, and they're all submissive to the interest of controlling the region. And Israel is that base that they have planted there, that evil, cancerous base, you know. But they're surrounded. They're surrounded by the axis of resistance by the Islamic Republic of Iran and its great work since the Islamic Revolution of Imam al-Khomeini, now that we've just commemorated 44 years. We were celebrating the anniversary. This revolution is what grew this strength and resistance. And the only solution to all these problems is real united resistance against the Israeli occupation.
Okay.
And we're seeing now that the resistance inside Palestine is growing on a heavy level. This young generation is very strong, very determined, and they're learning new tactics how to punish the Israeli regime, since the world is not truly punishing the Israeli regime or the United Nations and all these bodies that we're supposed to trust to do the job. So the Palestinians are going to have to do it themselves with their own heads. And they deserve weapons. They deserve to protect themselves. And this is the right of any nation that's oppressed and under occupation.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right. Well, Mohammed, the right-wing government of Netanyahu is facing increasing dissatisfaction and demonstrations from Israelis themselves. Protesters say the current government is trying to pass legislation to increase its power over the Supreme Court. Your overall assessment on this major discontent inside, and how do you see this possibly affecting the overall Palestinian situation?
Well, the current Israeli right-wing government led by Netanyahu and the right-wing coalition has been facing a very strong opposition in Israel since its establishment for about a month and a half now. Over the past 6 weeks, we have seen the Israeli leftist and center-left opposition protesting in the streets of Tel Aviv and other Israeli major cities like Haifa and Jerusalem. And today there was a big demonstration against the Israeli Knesset, which is overwhelmed by the Israeli right-wing political parties and Israeli religious parties. And the Israeli Knesset is trying to legalize or issue a new law that will reform the Israeli judicial system, which will, in a way, jeopardize the so-called Israeli democracy in the eyes of the Israeli left and center left. Now, definitely the Israeli right-wing government is facing a very tough political opposition inside Israel. And I think this Israeli protest that has been going on weekly in Israel is, in a way, benefiting the Palestinians by showing the ugly face of this current right-wing coalition government, which is opposed not by the Palestinians, it is opposed by its own people, the Israeli left and center left, who are protesting against this government. And I think we might very much see that this Israeli right-wing government will not be able to survive its 4 years term as a result of this Israeli internal opposition.
Well, Faris, on a practically daily basis, we see that the regime in Tel Aviv has either wounded or killed another Palestinian. And this seems to make the Palestinian population more resilient. And on the other side, we've seen more and more Israelis leaving or returning to their native countries or those of their parents. Your take on all of this, and where do you see this entity going in the future?
I think that the more extremist they go, the more, violations that they commit, the closer it is to the end of this regime that is crumbling. And hopefully we see more internal problems between the Israeli regime and its supporters and the different factions inside. And this is all good signs, actually. You know, we might, some people might look at it as a sign that we're in fear or we're having more people dying. But these people that die are martyrs. They're people that die for the sake of God, for humanity, for their nation. And it's not a normal nation. We're talking about Palestine is a holy nation for the Muslims, Christians, and Jews. It's a holy land of the prophets. This battle is a divine battle, and I think that the Palestinians have a right to resist, and this is the, honorable for them. And the Palestinians in this era right now, with all the social media, they're getting stronger and stronger, and they're getting more empowered. And let's hope that the more people in the world will always make videos and go out and protest and hold all these Western politicians accountable, unmask them if they're supporting the Israeli regime, especially if they preach and they promote human rights and they speak about, you know, that they care about people and humans and this and that. And then, you know, at the end of the day, they don't care about the Palestinians that have been occupied for 75 years. People are crying for the Ukrainian people saying that this place is occupied for about a year or so. But what about these Palestinians that have been occupied for 75 years? Do they not deserve respect? Do we not honor that they're martyrs and they're resistance fighters that fight the Israeli occupation, that commits all types of gruesome crimes? They steal people's houses, they demolish houses of the families of the martyrs in front of the eyes of their mothers and their daughters and their children. And their grandmothers and grandfathers have to see these things. They're uprooting their olive trees that they survive on, and this is the way they make their money. All these crimes are going to come to an end. And as the leader of the resistance group, Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, said, that this shows signs that this extremism of the Israeli regime could bring a closer end to the Israeli regime. And we're praying for this. We're praying for the liberation of the Palestinians and freedom, and for the people to live in honor and dignity and respect. And this is what the Palestinians deserve. And we will always support them from everywhere in the world. We cannot call ourselves a human rights defenders or supporters if we don't stand up for the Palestinians.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with us. Unfortunately, we're out of time, out of Gaza City. Mohammed Abu Saada, lecturer, Al-Azhar University. Out of Toronto, manager, Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Feras Al-Najm. And as always, we appreciate you being with us for another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have a very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Nur Muhammadpour. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh Nur Muhammadpour, most of the Shias pay visits to the holy shrine of their infallible imams, and they believe that there are some positive spiritual effects for this visitation and homage to the holy shrines of the infallible imams. For example, they go visit there, they even dedicate some of their money and their time, they give charity in the way of them, their vows are given on the way of, we can say, the infallible imams. And so many dedications and so many charities and the monies are spent in this way. And sometimes the people expect that, for example, the imam who is buried over there or the spirit of the imam might heal, for example, a sick person. And we see this case very much a lot, that the people refer to the holy shrine of an imam, they ask for their materialistic wealth. First of all, is it at all right to go to an imam and pay visit to him and ask, for example, for your materialistic needs, including your bodily sickness or something like that? And then, how is it that, for example, an imam who was martyred, we know that most of other imams were martyred or by poisoned, okay? They could not, by their own powers, heal themselves and heal, for example, their bodily sickness and bodily infection. How is it possible that they can now, after so many years, who are dead and who passed away, who are martyred, they can heal another person?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I just want to invite my dear listeners to go and to study. Many books has been written about the position and the traits of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salatu wassalam. It is very important. You know that paying visitation to the holy shrines of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salatu wassalam, actually it has a lot of physical and spiritual benefits for the visitor. There is no doubt about that. You know that according to the teachings of Shia school of thought, we believe that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala have gave some individuals, I'm talking about the pure progeny of Noble Prophet Muhammad and Noble Prophet Muhammad himself, some kinds of capacity and ability to become the mediator between the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to the people, which we call it wasitive faith,
which
to
means
be the mediator between the Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the people, which means that
faith means what, benevolence or something?
Yes, benevolence, okay. And the mercy of,
yes,
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala,
right.
Which means that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala via Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalatu wassalam send his graces and mercy to the people. Okay,
yes.
This is very important. You know, talking about the Noble Prophet Muhammad himself, I would just like to ask my dear listeners, why you send salutation to Noble Prophet Muhammad? Why in your daily prayer you say Assalamu alayka ayyuhan nabi wa rahmatullah wa all Muslim, peace be upon you, O Noble Prophet Muhammad? Why do you say that? Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, if you send salutation and your peace to Noble Prophet Muhammad, actually you ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because of Noble Prophet Muhammad, give you some other mercy. So you have this kind of the concept of intercession via all Muslim they do in the prayer. He say, "Assalamu alayka ayyuhan nabi." So Noble Prophet has been, according to the, you know, some ordinary understanding, especially, for example, Wahhabi people, Noble Prophet Muhammad has died. Yes. So why do you say, "Assalamu alayka ayyuhan nabi"? Why? This mm-hmm. is a question mark yes. here. Peace be upon you. It showed that a Noble Prophet Muhammad is alive. Physically speaking, yes, he passed away or martyred. But in other realm of the life, which is Barzakh, he is alive. And you send your mercy and peace to him, to Noble Prophet Muhammad.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So, of course, we have a lot of evidences for that. When we go and to pay visit to the Ahlul Bayt, you have to understand this point, that they have some kind of privileges from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And this is because of their servitude. You do not want to cause any, you know, confusion here. Very clearly, I want to say that they are a servant, righteous servant of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is granted. They are righteous servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And because of this servitude, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala have gave them a lot of merits, a lot of, you know, positive privileges. Okay? So, because of that, they are alive in other realm of life, and we go and pay visit to them, and we ask, for example, for, as you said, for the I don't know, financial problems, for the cure. Of course, we ask them to do some favor for
us.
Is
it at all recommended to ask, for example, a holy imam in a shrine for our materialistic needs?
Of course it is right. It is acceptable. Right. Okay. Yes, of course. Because, of course, you know, I have to explain these points. If you have some sicknesses or financial problems, we have some ordinary way for that. For example, go and work.
Mm-hmm.
Go to the physician. It is granted. Everybody, every human being by their intellect, they easily understand that.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I do not have control over all factors mm-hmm. in my life.
That's right.
How can I get a job? How can I get a proper job? How if they fire me out? How about thousands of problems that they are not in my control? Okay? So, if I want to have some kinds of, you know, success, even in this life, if I want to have any kind of, for example, cure for my illnesses, I have to resort to the some individuals who are the mediator between me and between Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and ask them for assistance. You know, I hope to be clear here. Of course I go to the physician, of course I do my best, and I do my all things that it is necessary for me to have the successful life, to get the cure of my illnesses, that's granted. But if I want to have, for example, control over many other things, okay, to be more successful, to facilitate for me my problems, any problem that I have, I need to ask assistance and intercession for the pure progeny of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salatu wassalam. I think all human beings by their nature, they understand it. Even in any kind of religion, if you go, they have, to some extent, they have the concept of resorting or seeking assistance from the, for example, a being, Almighty. Of course, they have some differences, or they mistakenly they go to the, for example, that guy, for example, some of them they go to the idol idol worshipping, unfortunately. But I wanted to explain about this tendency within the human being to resort to someone, to Almighty.